For more information on Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please visit our website.
Thank you, Tigan, for giving me the opportunity to give a talk and to continue to find ways to express my understanding of this practice. It's always a pleasure to sit with all of you, so thanks for sitting together today. I wanted to talk about my experience of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha today. Thank you also for chanting the refuges in Pali. It's always a delight for me. I find it very comforting, I think, to chant that for many reasons, but also it's like the singiest thing we do. And the first memories I have of chanting is at the end of Sesshin, and so I'm always in a very good mood at the end of Sesshin, looking forward to not sitting anymore and not being so sore and not constantly thinking about my pain. And more recently, when I've had the opportunity to go to Green Gulch, we chanted before bed. So it's also nice to think about taking refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha before bedtime, which is kind of what time it is now. So it's the same thing here again. So thank you. So I think, for me, I think a lot about taking refuge in Buddha, taking refuge in Dharma, and taking refuge in Sangha. And I think that for me, they're all very intertwined. And so I tried to kind of make sense of how I wanted to give this talk and say a little bit about all three, but it's so hard because I see them all so intertwined. But in terms of the Buddha, the human, the guide, you know, I also see Buddha as all of the teachers that I have, and all the teachers in many ways, not only Dharma teachers, but everyone who I learn from, all of my ancestors, all of our ancestors in this lineage, and I think about how everyone is equally the expression of Buddha nature, how important it is for me to lift up and feel gratitude for my teachers. I think my practice has continued to be one where I center not only my own suffering, but trying to understand the suffering of others, especially people who are in the margins. And that has led me to, you know, spend a lot of time reading works by people who are themselves in the margins. And I think I've spent a lot of time in the last 2 months or so visiting different divinity schools, talking to different professors and students, talking about their understanding of how Buddhism interacts with suffering, with white supremacy, with all of the difficulties that we experience. And I've specifically been talking about their Buddhist liberation of theology and what that looks like. And it's been really interesting to sort of investigate a field by connecting those threads of Buddhism and liberation theology, and how do they kind of fit and how don't they fit. And I'm kind of obsessed with making them fit right now. And I think as I think about this, I want to keep lifting up new teachers that I have been able, not really to meet, but to hear their talks, to read their books. And I've been thinking a lot about Lama Rod Owens. He co-wrote Radical Dharma, and he's been giving some really interesting talks, actually, like, all over the world. He's been traveling a lot, but he does a lot in Boston and New York, and I appreciate his creative ways of sort of looking at patriarchy within the Dharma. And I think I've recently found a priest who's studying at Clouds and Waters in Minnesota named Genjo Conway. He gives very interesting talks. If you want to be dizzy, you should listen to some of his talks. And I think non-Buddhists who I've been really kind of getting a lot from are Saidiya Hartman and Christina Sharp. Their work is really inspiring and brilliant. So I just lift up some of these names as a way for me to express gratitude. And I think about the Dharma, the teachings. There's so many teachings that I keep learning. You know, there's the obvious ones of the Four Noble Truths, and I think even the teaching within this teaching of taking refuge in the Three Jewels. And I also see the Dharma as our ancestors, as people who have studied under this lineage of Suzuki Roshi, who it's coming up on his... He died December 6th, I think, 1971. So I was thinking about that when I was writing this. And when I think about the Dharma, I think... How do I see the Dharma in everything? When is that alive within me? And I think of, I feel like every time I think about practice, I think about the four Bodhisattva vows, specifically beings are numberless, I vow to free them, delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. And I think of a quote from Katie Long, who works at Buddhist Peace Fellowship in Oakland. She says, "Truly liberatory change, both spiritual and political, actually happens over a much broader sphere than one nation's borders, and also over a much longer period. We're talking the scale of bodhisattva vows. We're talking lifetimes, generations upon generations, in a beautiful flowing river of wise effort to end suffering." And since I'm constantly thinking of these vows, it's nice to hear her creativity in them and naming it. It's a beautiful flowing river of wise effort to end suffering. I like that a lot. I think it's important to think about it in those terms. And I wonder, within these vows, I'm always wondering, so what are the values within them? How do I break them down for myself? What are the teachings saying about the suffering of others? How does one respond to that suffering, to that pain? What do the teachings say about my own pain? And I think I like to mention in my talks just some of the things that I'm struggling with in the moment, just to remind everyone that it's okay to talk about these things, and that it's nothing to be ashamed of, that we experience feelings of sadness or other difficult feelings, and that we aren't alone in that, and that we can do that work together. And I think my pain is in oftentimes not understanding myself fully, or not fully loving myself, of feeling like I'm not enough, or feeling fear of abandonment. And I think, how is me giving this talk an opportunity for me to heal some of those wounds? How is it part of my healing process? How can I heal communally? What is communal healing? And when I think of pain, I also think of where else is my attention, and how else can I respond besides speaking up or learning and studying. And I think about my gratitude practice, and about every morning when I wake up and have my tea and watch the sunrise, and the beauty that there is in this world as well. The snow outside, this little winter wonderland that we get to experience in November. And every day I pay attention to the clouds and what kind of beauty that they're communicating. And no matter where I am, no matter what mood I'm in, I can always count on them. And I think of the Metta Sutta, may all beings be happy, may they be joyous and live in safety. I want that for myself and for others. And when I think of Sangha, Sabine Selassie is a teacher, and I believe she lives in New York. I listened to one of her talks once, and she said that Sangha is a stepsister jewel. And I always laugh when I listen to that talk when she says that. I don't think Sangha is a stepsister jewel. I love Sangha. I love being able to sit with all of you, being able to get to know all of you in different ways. And I also see Sangha as the wider community. And Sangha as my ancestors, too. Those alive and those no longer living with us. Those who continue to teach me in many ways, who inspire me. And I think about what it's like to have, to be able to chant and recognize the women ancestors in this lineage, and in women who have done things maybe behind the scenes that we haven't seen all of their work, but we get to still say their names. And I think that's kind of recent, if my understanding is correct, that we chant those names, and I'm very grateful for that. And I think about, I think I still have some rawness around the things that have been happening in our country, the Kavanaugh trial, and I think It still feels very raw, and I feel like it's important for me to mention that there's two people who stood in the elevator and interrupted Senator Flake, and I can't stop thinking about them, and I want to continue to remember them and to say their names aloud because they inspire me. Ana Maria Archila and Maria Gallagher. And I feel grateful for them and for their courage. And it was a very difficult day for me, and I felt hopeless, and they provided an intense amount of hope. My coworker recently sent me an article from Jennifer Hernandez, who is a PhD student at the Seattle School of Theology and Psychology, and she says, women are making use of their prophetic voices to point to larger issues of dignity, worth, respect, and they are pointing to these issues with rage and frustration because for too long they have been told to be passive and deferential, and for too long they have been prisoners to a system they didn't create and which never accounted for their fullness of their humanity. This talk is not going to be about my opinions about rage, although I will do a further talk about that sometime. But I think it's a source of inspiration for me to hear these words and to think about prophetic voices. And I think also, as Adrienne Marie Brown says, it's my work to plant ideas that people aren't ready for. And as I continue to investigate what my Buddhist liberation of theology is, keep learning, keep making mistakes, and I think I also wanted to lift up some of the sacred moments that I've experienced in community, in Sangha, in different types of Sanghas recently, as I've been exploring this. When I went to New York recently, I got to go to the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture. It's part of the New York library system, but it houses a lot of amazing archives. And I was just starting to read a book by Imani Perry about Lorraine Hansberry, who she wrote A Raisin in the Sun, among other things, but she died very young. And it was really moving for me to just sit in this space where a lot of her archives are, a lot of her writings, and where I felt that she was coming alive for me there as I read in silence in the community of many other people. I felt just deeply moved, and it reminded me of another way to experience Sangha. And I think about just different conversation partners and students I met with when I visited a couple of schools on the East Coast, and just feeling their generosity as they were organizing a Buddhism and Race conference, and just being able to have to provide input for that and to have great conversations about that. And I'm thinking also about, I went a couple weeks ago to the University of Chicago to listen to a really brilliant talk by theologian Andrea White from Union Seminary, and just feeling captivated by her presence. I don't even know if I understood her talk that well, but what I did understand, it was touching, and she gave me more motivation to keep being inspired and to keep growing and learning and pushing myself in this work, in this practice. And the last example of how I've been in touch with Sangha and seen the sacred within that is, a couple of weeks ago, Union Seminary put on a panel of, they had a 3-day retreat with, I believe it was 30 Black Buddhist teachers, and 15 of them were on a panel and just talking about their experiences. And it was very, just a very special experience, I think, surely for all of them, and also for me to hear their voices and to hear how meaningful it was for them. And so as I can continue to think about how Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha lives within me, I'm wondering how you all frame Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha as your practice continues to blossom. So thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Katie, very much for lifting up a way of looking at central aspect of our practice of taking refuge from the rituals in connection with what's going on in the world and how our world is now. This has been a theme, I guess, the last month or so. Alison Offey spoke about Three Refuges here. I've spoken a couple of times about them recently, and you've added to that. So thank you. So, comments, responses, reflections, questions for Katie, please feel free. Yes, Jen.
Alison Offey's talk was very interesting to me. He went to Liberty Equality Fraternity, and compared them to Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, and that was a really interesting comparison. I thought that comparing Buddha to Liberty and Dharma to Equality and the Sangha. To community or fraternity. And when I say a strange take on it, I say it was at least quite different. And so I just wanted to mention that the Buddha Dharma Sangha triad applies. You can make it, or it applies to throughout the things that we experience in history and in our lives. And then I really wanted to hear more about the first thing, one of the first things you mentioned was the patriarchy in Buddhism. I wanted to hear more about what you had to say about it, if you don't mind, if you're very few.
No, I think I generally would just say that it's in all places. It's in all institutions, and we all have work to do.
Okay, so then I'll ask you, as the patriarch of ancient Bangladesh, what would you suggest that how would you suggest that this sangha, this is a sangha that you're very familiar with, how can we I'm not even sure what exactly what the question is, lift up women's wisdom and compassion. How can we what would you suggest, how can you help us?
I certainly don't have any answers, but I think that it starts with openness and an interest in learning. And so, like what I said, is one of the things that I do is I try to center my study on things that I don't know that much about. I try to center my study on reading and listening to voices of people who don't usually get much attention. And so that is how I better understand what it means to sort of understand the systems of oppression that we live under and my role in that. So I think my biggest recommendation is always just educating ourselves, reading, learning, being open. I don't think there's one right answer.
Thanks, Gary. Earlier in your talk, you had mentioned this model of fitting things together as a reflection of your pursuits, pursuing your studies, apparently, more formally. Or continuing to form one through that. That's provocative to me. I don't know if you might elaborate on that.
I think you're referring to just, or what I was referring to maybe is what I've been doing is studying like Latin American liberation theology and Black liberation theology, womanist theology, and trying to understand how that works and how that has worked, and then to try to understand perhaps how I can make that make sense with my understanding of Buddhism and where are there similarities, where I can learn different theories, I suppose. So that's kind of what I was talking about. And it's coming about in a lot of reading and conversations and listening to other talks and listening to talks by Christian theologians. And it's just a sort of exploration. A lot of curiosity.
Yes, sir. I'm really curious, and I don't know anything about this, but how do you see Buddhist liberation theology as being said different from Christian? Because I know you're studying both of them.
Sure. I don't think it has to be super different. I think maybe they're coming from somewhat different places and different ideas about how to put it. I think it's a good question. I'm not sure if I've really figured out a way to articulate it yet, but if you give me a second, I will try to put something together. I think one thing is the image of Christ and Christ as a revolutionary, perhaps. This is my own reading of it, how I want to read it. That's sort of a different lens, but for me, I think when we think about the four Bodhisattva vows, I feel that I'm interested in learning how this endless path to liberation, we have to keep working to liberate everyone, and we can't do it until everyone is free. So I see that as part of that liberation theology, my own interpretation of it, I suppose. So that's my, not that out answer. I'm sorry, it's not more productive.
Thank you. One that I'll throw in there.
Please.
Early on, you were talking about the prophetic, and that's certainly more from the Judeo-Christian side.
Mm-hmm.
But it's always been part of my expression of Buddha Dharma Sangha personally, and I feel like that's something that is that Buddhist liberation theology, whatever that is, can develop in a fresh way from exposure to Western liberation theology. So just that prophetic voice, which has many dimensions. Alan was speaking about that some too when he was here. Calling forth, prophetic is part of calling forth, as you were doing, some of the issues that need attention, calling forth ancestors and spirits who are addressing that and speaking up for that. And so that mode is one part. But I think Buddhism is a different way of doing it. Can't have. It's just, it's one of the things that's developing. It's not that it's absent in at all in Asian Buddhism, but it's, I think, developing in fresh ways in Western Buddhism. So just a thought.
Thank you. I'm also curious how people experience Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha in their lives. What's your take?
Well, Harold, I see Buddha think it's interesting that the longer I practice, the less I think, the less and less abstract it is. And sitting is very much a part of it. And so I sort of look at it in two ways. From a personal standpoint, practice is very much about unclenching the mind and acting out of that. And that unclenching the mind, that trying, that loosening, that absorption of self, and opening up to the world, it's the basis for a real sense that there are no boundaries. And our temptation is always to draw lines. And they're false lines. There are certainly differences, but there's not separation. And that's the sort of.
Thank you, Thomas. Thank you.
Thank you for sharing. It reminds me of an amazing thing that I never thought about before. Recently, because I'm in some art mainstream class, so I need to write some Dharma talks that's presented in my group. Then, you know, in my group, many of my co-workers, they are Christians, you know. So when I need to write something about Buddhism, I don't know, sometimes I never think so seriously about Buddhism, like when I need to write about it, to reach to a group. What I feel more is about, oh, actually I'm not living up to this philosophy. I feel I'm really, really far short of this, what we are supposed to think like. So, what do you feel? I feel, wow, I'm not doing this like this, you know, but I need to preach that reason. So what do you think?
I think that you're never falling short. I think you're too hard on yourself. But I think that the going back to the four bodhisattva vows, I mean, we're always going to keep working. None of these things are going to be accomplished in our lifetime. So just keep putting that effort out there and stop being so hard on yourself, too. You don't like that answer, though. You can follow up. I can see in your face.
I did have one further thought related to what you said, and Douglas is referring to too, I think, a little bit. There was a service for the officer that died last week, today, out in this lane. And I saw the whole thing because I was waiting at a service and I had the opportunity to watch it. And it was Catholic. It was administered by the cardinal himself. Our mayor is there, as was our governor. And it was pure saga, really. It was a gorgeous thing to witness. The deceased officer was Mexican-American. And his entire family was there. He's one of nine siblings. But the traditions, the memorial traditions within the Chicago Police Department are largely Irish, actually. So it was a curious soup of human harmony. And I find it miraculous when I observe, and it was really beautiful, the awkwardness of it. And I just wanted to say that.
Yeah, that reminds me. I was speaking with some pharmacy residents at the hospital that I work at right after the event, the violence at Mercy Hospital, and they were saying, you know, they don't have rituals like the police do for memorializing this pharmacy resident who died that same time. And they're saying just the lack of the ritual feels like they don't know what to do with themselves. They don't know how to move on. And so that just the act of not having a typical ritual or memorial was really making their grief even tougher.
So many good comments. Thank you all. Thank you, Katie. Just one thought. What Douglas is saying about what, going back to what is Buddhist liberation theology, one thing that Buddhism adds to the idea of liberation is the synonym of awakening. So you're talking about justice, which I think is very much to the point in relation to suffering, but also this liberation as an awakening. There's a lot of what he's saying on that. Katie, any closing comments?